We've been treating kids at Regions for a little more than 15 years. We have an embedded children's hospital within the building, the Gillette Children's Specialty Hospital.
Now, who is that? Whose voice is that? Well, that's none other than Michael McGonigal, Director of Trauma at Regions Hospital in St. Paul, Minnesota, and the author of the best blog on trauma out there today, the Trauma Professionals blog. Oh, and I guess I should mention, in case you haven't figured it out already, you're listening to the MCRIT podcast, and my name is Scott Weingart. Now, Dr. McGonigal works in a level one pediatric trauma center. But a lot of places around the country, they're not pediatric trauma centers. They're just a regular trauma center, and yet they're taking young children who have suffered major traumas, and they have to take care of them. They might transfer them later on, but the initial management is theirs, and people are worried, people are scared, and hopefully you could help them out a bit. And
I sympathize with them too, Scott, because when we started, there was a lot of angst in our emergency department with our emergency physicians gnashing their teeth going, oh, I don't know if we can do this. And really, it takes, besides just getting the kids, even before you get to that point, it's very important to really step up the education. So everybody had to start getting PALs, everybody had to start extra pediatric trauma continuing medical education, both physicians and nurses, so that everybody could get comfortable and get to that point where anytime you get a really small kid, everybody's anxiety levels goes up, up, up.
That's the truth. And, you know, if you show me a 6 or 7 year old, I feel like those really are little adults for the most part. I feel comfortable. But the case we're going to talk about is a 2 year old. And that's the really tough part. These babies, these really young children, those are the ones that really scare us. So why don't we move into the case and then we'll deal with some general questions afterwards. So this is a 2 year old unrestrained motor vehicle crash. Patient comes in. In the original case, the patient was intubated, but let's make it even tougher for you. The patient's unintubated. EMS is bagging the patient because the patient only has intermittent respirations, and they describe a squishy head. They say when they feel the patient's parietal region, it's actually moving under their fingers, and that's all they really could give you. They couldn't get a blood pressure because they couldn't find a cuff small enough, and they just wanted it out of their hands and into yours. What is your first move on a patient like this?
Just like any trauma patient, first of all, as soon as you get the call and you know it's a 2 year old kid who's in that bad of shape, everybody gets excited. So first thing is that make sure you've got your trauma team assembled. And the key thing, I think, is to get the team leader to brief the team at that point. This serves to kind of get people organized, get them thinking about what they need to do. And it takes a little bit of the anxiety off, because everybody starts to think, okay, well, the team leader knows what the heck they're doing. And just to simply take a minute or two to say, hey, we've got a 2 year old kid, soft, squishy head, airway issues, and here are our initial maneuvers, and just rattle them off. And just like in any trauma patient, when you're getting started, you go with the ATLS stuff. So you know the first thing you're going to go for is the airway, and make sure you've got your airway person primed. They can sit there and figure out, okay, what size ET tube am I going to use? They can start thinking about any drugs that they want to use and have those ready. And just go through the sequence: airway, breathing, circulation, disability, and then usually those kids are already exposed, although they probably shouldn't be that early because they will cool down fast.
So let's move in then to our ABCs. So airway. Would you be more or less aggressive intubating a young child than you would an adult?
If you have an idea that this is a head injury, you pretty much do treat the kids the same as the adults. We do know that head injury and hypoxia, or head injury and hypotension, are bad. And so as soon as you put the two together, you go, well, we've got to get an airway. And the nice thing about kids of this size is that getting the airway is actually pretty easy because you're dealing with a fairly short conduit. Assuming that you can pick the right tube, then probably the most important thing is, and I've seen this mistake made, is overinflating the cuff. You don't want to do that. I've seen a couple of tracheal injuries now, primarily from intubations in the field by EMS, but it could happen anywhere.
So you have moved to cuff tubes, even in these young children, which a lot of centers have.
Yeah, pretty much. We have a pediatric intensivist that is part of our trauma team when we get a pediatric page that goes over. And basically what they told us is that as soon as that you move them up into the peds ICU, if you have an uncuffed tube in, we're going to change it to a cuff tube. So we've just gone to using all cuffed.
All right. So you've made, at the trauma leader, made the decision this baby clearly needs to be intubated. But obviously, before that point, you want to do a quick neuro exam before the patient receives any medications. What are you looking for on a baby to assess mental status?
Just actually going for that pediatric GCS. Just look at their crying, their movements, et cetera. And again, make sure that that gets recorded, because as you mentioned, you're going to lose that as soon as you start giving the meds. And it's going to be a while before they start moving again and reacting again.
All right. So to everyone's relief, this was an easy airway. The baby has a tube through the cords. There was a pediatric easy cap indicating proper placement, and now an airway is placed. What is your next step?
Next step is just check the breathing. Make sure that, you know, you've got your technology there telling you things look pretty good, but do a good old physical examination. You can see the chest rising because, again, it's a short conduit, which means it's an easy mainstem intubation. And unfortunately, in kids, they're a little different than adults. You can actually slip it down either way, left or right, whereas in adults, you typically, if you push it in too far, it goes down the right. So double check to make sure that you've got good ventilation on both sides, and then keep on moving.
Now, this baby, when you listened, there was actually absent lung sounds on the right. And you confirmed yourself that the tube appeared to be at its proper position in terms of depth. Pediatric chest tubes, very, very worrisome. What do you do differently than you would in an adult?
The main thing is making sure that you have a reasonably small tube. Obviously, you can't go huge like you do in the adults. You want to get one that's age appropriate, and you can use whatever reference cards you want to ensure that. But basically, it's very similar. The only thing that I found that technically different is that the pleura in kids, in this size child, as well as I would say most kids who are in their single digit age range, the pleura is extremely tough, and it's very difficult unless you're using a fairly sharp instrument like a very pointy hemostat to actually poke through it. And given that you are working with relatively small distances from chest wall to important stuff like the heart, you've got to be very careful how you do that. And what I usually recommend is that, and this goes for adult chest tubes as well, what I'll do is I'll put my fingers a distance away from the end of the point and hold it so that the hemostat or the clamp that's being used, my thumb is, in adults, a couple of centimeters away, in children, a relatively shorter distance. And as I push, I pinch tightly with my fingers so that if it does pop unexpectedly and go through, my fingers act as the stop to keep the clamp from going through and hitting bad things like the heart.
Those are two fantastic tips. Now, in adults, I puncture through with my finger. Is the pleura too tough on a baby to do that?
In my experience, it has been. I have a real tough time, even with fairly, you know, sharp hemostats. I can't emphasize too much. It is really tough, and it makes it such that you can accidentally poke in too far pretty easily.
I think if we stop there, this would already be incredibly valuable just for that tip. Okay, so you get a chest tube.
But the one other thing I would add, though, is that those PALS cards have ranges. And so typically in a drawer, you'll have two or three possible tube sizes. And this goes for chest tubes, urinary catheters, et cetera. And what I always do is I take the one that's recommended and I hold it up and I look at it compared to the patient. Because I have had a number of occasions where the urinary catheter recommended, I look at the urethral orifice and I go, no way. So then I pick a smaller size. So it's a guideline. Use it as such. But again, we don't see so many of these kids, you know, every week or so that I can just go, oh, yeah, well, this is a 8 French or whatever.
Absolutely. So you get the chest tube in it and some blood comes out, not an enormous amount. And now the other side's lungs sound good. They feel good. And now you have breath sounds on this side as well. Your next step, I imagine, is going to be C. How do you assess circulatory in a baby?
Correct. And that can be challenging as well. The two-year-old's not quite as bad, but you should be able to get an easy pulse exam in these kids. And you can. My favorite is just the groin. It's fairly easy to get at, even though people are clustered around tightly around these kids generally. But it's easy to get at. You can get a quick feel for how fast it is and how robust it is, and that'll give you some idea. At the same time, you can get nurses trying to get a blood pressure cuff on somewhere.
So now we're doing two things simultaneously. We're trying to assess, and we're also trying to get IV access. On your assessment, the baby's pulse rate has dropped to around 45. They can't find a blood pressure. And right now, there's no IV access. What's going through your mind as a trauma leader?
A couple of things. First of all, bradycardia in a child, and this is a two-year-old, so she should have, you know, she should be in the low hundreds at least, and probably more. She should probably be a bit more tachycardic than that. And in my mind, bradycardia is a sign of impending arrest. Now, it can also be part of a Cushing response, so they've got high intracranial pressures. But in your initial assessment in these kids, like in any trauma patient, your first assumption is that somehow this is caused by bleeding. Because of the two things that kill people in major trauma are bleeding and massive CNS injury. And we can do something about bleeding if we can figure it out. Massive head injury, we can't quite do that much. We can't do much at all. So first of all, assume bradycardia equals near arrest, which equals hemorrhage from somewhere. So figure that out quickly, and also start talking to other people on your team, because you may need to start thinking about CPR soon.
So at what point, even with a pulse with bradycardia, would you start CPR?
Again, it's age dependent, but in a child like this, once you start getting into the 80, 60, and really less than 60 range, I would consider starting to do CPR. There was a study done, God, I'm trying to think how long ago that was. It was a review of a national CPR database, and I think it was out of CHOP in Philadelphia, and just a few years ago. And they basically found that, and again, this wasn't specifically trauma, this was overall kids, but they found that for kids who had CPR started for what they considered bradycardia or poor perfusion, they're compared to CPR in kids who had arrested, they found that there were more of the kids in the former group that got out of the hospital alive. So it's probably a good idea if you consider that this child is, quote, significantly bradycardic, whatever number you want to pick for that, you should probably start CPR to supplement them at that point.
Got it. Now, on an adult, once I've taken the chest out of the picture, I'm going to be calling for blood on a patient like this because my assumption is bleeding. Are you doing the same on a baby?
And that's my first assumption until proven otherwise.
So,
although given this, in this kid with a squishy head, it's going to be in the back of my head also, but I'll start with bleeding.
So would you be empirically giving this baby blood at this point?
Am I able to feel pulses? Do I have good pulses? Or
you could feel pulses. They're thready, and the baby's bradycardic still in the low 50s.
And I would, if I hadn't called for it before the child arrived, if I hadn't gotten the information that would tell me I probably needed to, I would call for it at this point. And as soon as we had a decent line in, I would start it. You can always stop it.
What would be your line of choice in a baby like this?
And you said in this particular case, you were having a tough time getting lines.
Yeah, so nurses are trying on both arms. They can't find a vein.
And I would just automatically pull out the drill and put a nice, careful IO in their tibia.
Okay, IO is now in. Are you giving crystallite? Are you giving blood? Are you giving nothing at this point?
At this point, I would start with the blood. And I would dearly love to have another IV so that we could get some crystalloid and have a conduit for drugs as well.
Now, in adults and in sick trauma patients, we give very little crystalloid at this point. Has that transitioned to babies as well?
The problem with pediatric trauma is that, first of all, the adult literature doesn't transition well. Look at the solid organ stuff. And it's a real problem. And a lot of good studies avoid using kids just because of the hassles of getting consent. So we pretty much are flying by the seat of our pants. And the best that we, for the most part, the best that we know is to try to parallel what we do in adults. So crystalloid is good within limits. And especially if you've got a kid like this where there's the possibility of a brain injury, that even may make you consider moving to some other vasoactive drugs earlier than you normally would.
So that's a great point. Now, we know we generally avoid pressors and hemorrhagic shock in adults, but is it different in babies? Will they benefit from some epi? Is the bradycardia so pervasive that if you don't treat it, they're not going to have any hemodynamic stability?
I think in a case like this, I would actually go more with atropine, a little bit of atropine, and possibly some epi. But The honest truth is we don't know for sure. So my preference is to go with crystalloids, and at least until I get some idea whether or not it helps. If you can give us a, you know, a 20 cc per kilo flush and you see a response, then you look for the bleeding source and consider switching early to blood. If you're not really seeing much of a response, then you're really probably dealing with a serious brain injury primarily, and then you can reach for the other drugs to try to reduce the amount of crystalloid that you're about to give.
Fair enough. So let's see if we could find the bleeding. Yeah, is a fast exam still valid in a baby this small? Can you even fit the probe on them?
That's a great question, and that's something I've actually written about a couple of times. When you're talking about hypotension, and this is true in adults as well, if it's due to intra-abdominal bleeding, you should see it on the fast. The problem with kids is that many kids have a small physiologic amount of peritoneal fluid, and so sometimes you'll see a wisp of fluid on the fast exam. A wisp of fluid won't make you hypotensive. So in either kids or adults, if they're hypotensive from bleeding into the peritoneal cavity, you should be able to see it on fast. The exception would be if you've got somebody with, a concomitant chest injury, they've got pneumothorax with lots of sub-Q emphysema, or they're extremely obese, which hopefully you're not dealing with in kids this age, then you might have some issues. But in general, fast is great for the abdominal compartment because your exam is not.
Okay. Now, let's say at this point, the fast was positive for more than a wisp of fluid. You think an intraperitoneal source of bleeding is the source of the patient's instability in addition to the presumed head injury. What is your next step?
Are you a center that has the capability of doing some surgical procedures on this child? Do you have either a pediatric surgeon or a general surgeon who's comfortable?
Let's say for argument's sake, at first, this is your center. So you have everything you could possibly want.
Okay. Then at that point, we would very rapidly finish up the rest of the evaluation in the ED. I'm not a big fan of aborting our stay in the ED to run up to the operating room. It's two floors above. It's, 100 feet down the hall. And so I want to make sure that we've got a good airway, we've got good access, and that we've got things kind of packaged up and our basic x-rays, if indicated, before we go up to the operating room. It takes a couple of extra minutes, but it keeps you from having that problem. Just as the elevator doors close, the monitor battery runs out, and all these other things, everything that can go wrong happens in the elevator. So to kind of shorten the answer here, what I would do is make sure that we quickly finish the usual, ATLS evaluation routine. But at that point, plan on proceeding directly to the operating room afterwards and giving one of our pediatric neurosurgeons a call to tell us to meet us up there.
Now, there are a few interesting questions come up, particularly in a baby like this. We know adults can't exsanguinate into their head. It's not a source of bleeding. Babies can. Would you get a CT on this baby first to see if there is a brain injury? Or is the operating room going to be your first destination in pretty much any source of hemorrhagic shock with instability? What is there any change in your management?
If you've identified an abdominal source, then that's one that you can fix. If and you're right, in kids, you can put a fair amount of blood in the head because it expands like a bag. And in that case, you can, but you can't fix that. So the idea is that you go for the things that you know you can fix. And if that is the only thing, the only problem, things are good. You fixed it. If you go in there and you take care of that, but still they've got a bag of blood in their head, then you're still stuck. At that point, you can go to CT scan. In general, what I always say is that a hypotensive trauma patient can't go anywhere except for the operating room. Now, there are a couple of exceptions people have pointed out, and they're correct. And that is, if you have a patient that you believe has an isolated, catastrophic brain injury, you found absolutely nothing else to account for their hypotension, then I will go to the CT scanner with the idea of documenting that they have a catastrophic injury, with the idea we'll probably be withdrawing support sooner rather than later. But when I do that, we have trainees. So when I do that, I always turn to the team and I say, listen, we are going to break the rule, and here's why.
Because
make sure that the emergency medicine residents and the surgical residents understand that this is not a routine. this is not recommended. This is a special case, and here's why.
That's a fantastic point. So let's say instead of the situation we just discussed, you gave one equivalent of a unit of blood to this baby, and all of a sudden, vitals are better. Pulse rate does come up to the low hundreds. Blood pressure now is, let's say, 50 over 30, something reasonable. And you still think there might be some intraperitoneal bleeding. What's the role of non-operative management in a baby?
You have to make sure that there's something in the abdomen that you shouldn't be operating on. So ultimately, in the situation you describe, assuming that they've stabilized and you're happy with their vital signs, then you will need to evaluate the abdominal contents. The standard these days is CT scan. We're actually trying to change that a little bit. And in kids who are not as badly hurt as this, we're actually doing a complete abdominal ultrasound with an ultrasound tech and a radiologist to evaluate everything. But in a child like this, with potentially bad head stuff as well, we would just go over to the CT scanner and have a look, because then you can decide, oh, this is a serious spleen injury, this is a liver injury, and the majority of the time you can manage them non-operatively as long as they never drop their blood pressure again.
So they get basically one shot at it. If they get any other instability, then they need to go to an operating room.
That's correct, because these days failure of solid organ management is measured in hypotension for the most part. If you have a vital signs disturbance, that's failure. So if, and many adults will do this, where you'll give them, they'll come in with an initial pressure of 80. They got some abdominal pain, say a T-bone crash, and so you're suspecting one of the two big solid organs. You get their first liter of crystalloid, and everything's great. They look fine. Their vitals are great. Their tachycardia is better. You go over to CT scan, and you see the injury. And let's say that as you're there, you see that a grade 3 spleen comes up. But they're still in the scanner, and suddenly their pressure drops to 70. They've just failed. They can't go non-operative management anymore. Same thing for kids.
That's very fair. Now let's talk about the much harder situation. Same patient, but now you're getting a phone call from an outside community center. What are you advising them over the phone? How much management do you want done by them, and how much do you want done by you?
Right. This is a tough one, because let's say it's the scenario you painted, where you've got a kid who we've detected, or they've detected by FAST, that there is blood in the abdomen and they've been hypotensive, and there's a suspicion that that is the source. Do they have a surgeon? Some centers will, some surgeons will not. And then, so some people will say, well, if they've got a surgeon, then they've got to go in and do something before they send the kid regardless. In this day and age, that's not necessarily true, because if you think about it, in that particular center, they may have a surgeon, but they've got 30 minutes or so to get into the hospital. They get in and go, oh, well, we've got a hypotensive kid. We need to go to the operating room. So then they call their OR team, and let's say this is a weekend, so they've got 30 minutes to get in. The amount of time that you have wasted there, you know, at least an hour before you get somebody who is very uncomfortable with doing what they're going to have to do, versus tossing them into a helicopter and getting them to your center in a shorter period of time where you've got a team all ready to go. So you have to know your referring hospitals. And if they have what it takes, if they've got people on duty, they've got a team there, and everything happens at, you know, 9 o'clock in the morning, then you can consider having them just do a kitty damage control laparotomy to stop the bleeding, get them down to you. If they don't have the depth of resources to do that, then get them in a helicopter as quickly as possible, have your ORs warmed up and ready to go.
That makes sense. Do you want them bothering to do any imaging there, or should they wait for you?
Absolutely not. It's pretty clear that what I always tell people whenever I go out and talk at our referring hospitals, one of the slides I always have is that do what you need to figure out if you can keep this child. But as soon as you have seen something that you know you can't take care of and you know that you're going to transfer out, stop all imaging. Because the truth is, about 50% of any outside imaging is going to end up being repeated. And that's almost a crime in a child, where you're irradiating a child twice just for that reason.
Makes complete sense. Let me ask you some questions off the case just to finish up. has the hemostatic resuscitation paradigm, one-to-one matching, emerged in the pediatric trauma world as well?
No, it's primarily adult. Again, this is one of those things where it kind of makes sense. And so I think that people are translating it that way, especially at the higher level pediatric centers. But that's purely a military concept that's been translated into adults with some degree of success. And I think we'll start to see the same thing in kids as well.
But not yet. At this point, it's pretty much blood unless there's coagulation markers.
At places where, unfortunately, I'll probably offend people, but at places where there are pediatric surgeons, they tend to lag a little bit behind in those concepts, mainly because they're not exposed to the adult concepts to transfer them over to kids. So sometimes you'll see a little bit of a lag there. But if you're at a center where you've got a hybrid model where you have adult surgeons and pediatric surgeons, they tend to adopt those things a little bit quicker.
Fair enough. Is there any differences in the management of presumed pediatric intracranial pressure elevations? Let's say you have a blown pupil. In adults, we'd give hypertonic if they were hypotensive. We'd give mannitol if they were hypertensive. What are you doing in peds?
In kids, hypertonic stuff actually is good. I think there were a set of guidelines that were published in pediatrics. It's probably been about, probably about 8 years ago or so. Where they basically came out with a set of guidelines saying in kids with evidence of intracranial hypertension, hyperosmolar therapy is good. And they said either mannitol or hypertonic solutions. They also were very clear that there's really not much good literature to support it. And this is kind of an extension from the adult world as well. And they didn't specify what degree of hypertonic saline. Is it 3%, 23%? So these are the kind of things that you need to figure out for your particular center in advance so that you've got the right drug there and you've got the right dose there. For me, again, I'm old-fashioned, I guess. It's easier. But for me, I can easily remember 1 gram per kilo of mannitol, and it's usually readily available. Whereas if I ask for hypertonic saline, then we've got to call the pharmacy. They want to know 3%, 23%, how much do you want? And I always have to say, well, you better look that one up. So
fair enough.
Either one is a reasonable choice and will be helpful. The key is that if you see a focal exam, so they've got a pupil or they're only moving half of their body, then they need it. Or if you suspect based on your examination of their head or fontanelles that they've got some increased pressure, then give it arbitrarily. Pick whichever one that you'd like and then make sure that at some point in the near future they will have a pediatric surgeon looking in because they will need some type of monitoring.
Absolutely. Now, you mentioned when you were gearing up to be a trauma center that folks had to get additional pediatric trauma education. I haven't found good sources for that. What are you recommending when people ask?
There are not a whole lot of good ones out there. There are some conferences around the country. I know the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia puts on a conference that rotates between Philadelphia and Pittsburgh every year, but it's a 2-day conference. You got to travel, all that kind of stuff. There really is not a lot of good outside stuff. There are a few online resources. What we typically do is we have a trauma multidisciplinary conference every month. And typically, at least one of the 3 conferences every quarter, we tap one of our pediatric trauma experts, either within our institution or within one of the other trauma centers within the Twin Cities or within the Children's Hospital Network, to come over and give us a talk in some way related to trauma. So we've had our pediatric neurosurgeons give great talks on pediatric head injury. We've had a pain specialist from the Children's Hospital of Minnesota or Children's Hospital in Minneapolis come over and talk about pediatric pain management. So what I would recommend is identify the resources in your own community because you have people who are very knowledgeable with this stuff. If you're a small community and you know your experts are a little further away, just make an effort to tap them and see if they're willing to have somebody come out and give you a couple of talks, both physician and nursing talks. It's even great if you can get EMS involved, if you can get somebody that can speak to them as well, just so that everybody can benefit from and again, drop their anxiety levels a little bit when they get that two-year-old kid that comes in.
Let's close up by asking you, do you have any things you just have seen time and time again that you just do not want done ever again in a pediatric trauma?
A couple of things I think we already touched on, and probably the biggest bugaboo is don't leave the emergency department with a hypotensive patient unless you're going to go operate. One of the things in this particular case, let's say that the child was bradycardic and you did have to start CPR. One of the things that I think is very helpful is to immediately split your team so that you've got a couple of people that are responsible for the chemical code, the ACLS or PALS type stuff, and then other people who are responsible for the trauma evaluation part, the exam, the FAST, et cetera. Because if to have one person trying to concentrate on both of those is very challenging. And we also recommend this, let's say that in the adult situation where you are justified in doing an ED thoracotomy, it's best to split your team into the team who's going to run the code and the team who's going to open the chest. That way each can concentrate on their specific very specialized task and do it well.
That's a fantastic tip, both for adults and for peds. Well, I can't thank you enough, Dr. McGonigal. If folks want to read what I think is the best blog on trauma today, it's the Trauma Professionals blog, and we will have the link to that in the show notes. So that's it for today. I think that was pretty incredible. Now, if you just listen to this and you're an attending or you're a nurse or paramedic and you're not getting credit for it, then what's wrong with you? Why wouldn't you want to get CME credit, continuing education credit, for spending the time you just did? You could be getting an hour for this episode. If you're curious how, just go to cme.mcrit.org or just go on over to mcrit.org and the link to the CME stuff is there. I am appearing on airwayworld.com. That's Ron Wall's Airway podcast and webcast site. Talk about CPAP pre-oxygenation and DSI on Thursday, the 28th. Details of that can be found at airwayworld.com if you're interested. It's totally free, and I think it's pretty cool. So come on over. All right, we've gone way over my normal time, so I'm going to stop here. Scott Weingart, MCRIT Podcast, saying bye-bye.